Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you very much for being here. We have one presenter on the 1556, Senator Hansel, who is going to be leading off. Because he's not here, I'm going to go ahead and take the other one first, and that will give us a little bit more, him a little bit more time to get here, as well as us to complete the work on the other bill that we need to do today. So we're going to be starting with a public hearing on Senate Bill 1538. And so open up the public hearing. Whitney?
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 1538, and you may recall it from the 2017 session when it was Senate Bill 693. Senate Bill 1538 does three main things. One, it replaces probationary permits with hardship permits and makes modifications to the hardship program. Second, it eliminates several bases for suspension of a driver's license unrelated to driving, such as for littering. And finally, it makes driving privilege provisions for members and spouses of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to drive within Oregon, similar to those provisions for military members. There's also a dash one amendment for your consideration, which removes Section 20 from the bill. Section 20 would have prohibited the Department of Revenue from suspending a CDL or commercial driver's license for non-payment of certain taxes. There is a fiscal impact, and we are currently waiting on the revenue impact to come in. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I have two individuals that have signed up for testimony, Tori Lynn and Amy Joyce. If you two would come forward while they're coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1538?
And actually, I would, Mr. Chair.
We'll let you start off.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
You want to go ahead and come on up? And Senator Denborough, why don't you go ahead and give us the lead off?
Sure. Just, you know, colleagues, this bill may look very familiar to you, and that's because we passed it last year. We passed it on the floor, and the House passed it on the floor, but there were some last-minute conforming amendments that had to be added over on the House side. And by the time it came over to us, we were already in our cars driving home on that day. And
shucks.
So that's why it's before you. There is one change, as Whitney said, and this came at the request of the Department of Revenue. We have, you'll remember that we had a task force on reentry and employment and housing. That's been replaced. The chair created a work group on reentry and housing, in housing and employment, and that has been meeting, and we discussed this issue. We discussed the DOR concern and agreed that it made sense, and so that change was made. This is an issue, this issue of trying to limit driver's license suspensions to driving offenses is something that I think the work group is going to continue to work on. And so I encourage us to once again pass this bill.
All right, thank you. So I'm going to let the three presenters present in the order that they think is most appropriate. So whoever would like to lead off with your name, please.
I can start now, I guess. Good morning, Chair Brzozinski. My name is Tori Lynn. I'm the director in the Lynn County Juvenile Department. I'm here today to represent the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. The section in this bill around removing suspensions is why I'm here this morning. And we would request that the committee really look at a couple of areas. One of those are the, and you've been provided some written testimony, and it highlights each of the sections in the areas that I'm talking about. And it's relating to the ability of juveniles to lose their driving privilege if found to have violated Oregon's laws related to drug and alcohol marijuana use. Additionally, the provisions around the authority of parents to cancel driving privileges for their children and the current educational requirements associated with emancipated minors obtaining their driver's license. We all know that getting our driver's license is a huge deal for a teenager. You get to experience new freedom, take on additional responsibilities as we're working towards adulthood. The ability to, the removal of the ability to suspend youth licenses would be counterproductive to our efforts to reduce teen drinking, marijuana use, to reduce the dropout rate for our youth by incentivizing their attendance in educational programs, and the ability of a parent to determine the privileges of their teenager whom they're legally responsible for. I did was trying to pull up some research that would kind of help drive home my point a little bit. I did find one study that was completed in 2012. They looked at over 220,000 youth between the ages of 16 and 17 over a 10-year period using the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System. Now, that's not a system I'm familiar with, but this group was conducted by the Addiction Technology Transfer Network, and it was funded by SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse Mental Health System Administration. This group has been around since 1993. They've got a number of offices, one at the University of Washington. The three primary things from this research indicated that teen drivers in the U.S. are overrepresented in motor vehicle accidents. They're actually the highest, 16 and 17-year-olds are actually the highest risk per mile driver for accidents. The next group closest would be those that are 80 and over. So they're very high risk to be in accidents to begin with. The effects of graduated driver's licensing, like we have here in Oregon, that has some limits around when you get your license, there's certain things you can and can't do. For example, you can't have friends in your vehicle for the first 6 months. You can't use cell phones, handheld or even using them non-handheld. And the use and lose laws like we have here for if you're a minor in possession of alcohol, you would lose your license among high school youth. Both of those, the findings from this study indicated that both those state laws, if they are strong, can reduce hazardous drinking and driving behaviors among teens. The key finding in the study was that states that had restrictive GDL laws and use and lose laws had less youth who reported driving after drinking alcohol and riding in a car with someone who had been drinking. In other words, a student in a state with the strongest GDL and use and lose laws would be approximately half as likely as a student in a state with weaker GDL and use laws to drive after drinking. These findings mean that these two laws, if they're strong, can have a significant effect on teen behavior and save lives. Parents and clinicians should reinforce the awareness of teens to these laws and work to get weak laws strengthened. And that was a statement by one of the researchers. Driver's license suspensions are tools that schools, parents, and juvenile departments have successfully used and relied upon as a deterrent to youth to use drug and alcohol. At a time when we're working hard to reduce absenteeism and increase graduation rates, it's not a time to take away a valuable incentive for kids to stay in school. At a time when we're facing rising risks of deadly addictions, it's not a time to take away tools that deter kids from using drugs and alcohol in their formative years. Driver's license are important to many kids. They're often the only tangible consequence that really makes sense to them. In general, we don't revoke licenses as punishment. The first time a youth is involved with the juvenile department, the majority of the time when a kid gets an alcohol or drug-related referral, that's diverted, it's handled informally, it's really focused on education, helping them understand the risks of drinking and driving or using and the effects of that on their brain development. It's the second referral that would normally be taken to court, and that's when they could use, be in risk of losing their license at that point. The possibility and the revocation acts as a motivator and incentive for youth to stay on the right path and not use. OGA would urge you to remove the sections that are outlined in the written testimony, sections 19, 23, 24, 26, 27, and 28, from the Senate Bill 1538 and preserve the use of current laws relating to driving privileges sanctions. These laws serve threefold purpose. They can be a valuable deterrent, a meaningful consequence, and part of Oregon's overall efforts to make teen drivers safer. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And who's, Amy, are you going next, or?
Sure. Chair Pruszanski, members of the committee, my name is Amy Joyce. I'm with the Oregon Department of Transportation today representing the DMV, and based on the co-presenters, some of those comments, also, I guess, our safety division. So I'll start out with kind of the backbone of the bill, which Senator Dembro sort of introduced. I mean, at any one time, we have 650,000 Oregonians suspended, their driver's licenses suspended. We have 2.6 million active suspensions on driver license records. And every year, we add approximately 360,000 suspensions on 200,000 individual people. And nationally, but there has been a movement to sort of reduce or eliminate suspensions, driver's license suspensions, for things unrelated to driving. Oregon suspensions laws are very complex. There are over 400 different codes in the DMV system for various suspensions and revocations. And hardship permits are an aspect of that complexity. And while there hasn't been really any testimony so far about the hardship permit aspect of the bill, I do want to address that quickly. So the bill does eliminate several driver's license suspensions not related to driving, like school attendance issues, littering, theft of gasoline. The minor in possession provision was changed from the original version of the bill in 2017, so that now if that minor in possession offense is related in any way to a vehicle, then a suspension is still available. I believe that's under Section 26. The bill also eliminates probationary permits for revocations. We have two different types of permits DMV issues under the law, probationary and hardship permits. They effectively do the same thing, but they're four different underlying offenses. So what the bill does is sort of unify that as a hardship permit, sort of makes standard the reasons one can get a hardship permit and what you are allowed to do with that hardship permit. The only deviation from that is if your suspension is due to a driving under the influence charge, then you also need an ignition interlock device to be able to get that hardship permit. Final thing it does, it eliminates the ability to get a hardship permit for a second DUI offense. And in response to some of my co-presenters' information, I would say that certainly a person operating a vehicle under the influence would be subject to suspension. If you're in a car, minor in possession, that's related to the operation of a vehicle, you'd still be subject to suspension for that. So those are sort of what the bill does and what some of the outcomes are that we're trying to achieve, that the bill tries to achieve.
All right, thank you.
excuse me, for the record, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And we're here, we did come in and talk with the work group on the Section 20, which is the Dash 1 amendment change. The Section 20, we understand, was inadvertently picked up in the sweep for different types of license suspensions. And when a bill was originally drafted, and we came to the work group to explain what the Statute 305-385 does. It allows the Department of Revenue to suspend an occupational license for failure to pay tax after we've done everything we can to collect the tax. It's a tool of last resort. It has nothing to do with whether they're a criminal or whether they're trying to come back into the workforce. But instead, it's a collection tool that we have. We can suspend. There's over 500 different types of occupational licenses in the state. Elsie came in and testified to that with the work group. By saying in this particular statute that we can't suspend a driver's license that's an occupational license, we were treating classes of taxpayers differently because we could only we could suspend everyone else, an electrician, a plumber, a hairdresser, anyone else who's required to be licensed for their occupational purposes. But the bill, as drafted, would not allow us to suspend a trucker's license, and we needed to understand the legal basis for that difference, and the committee understood, I believe, the workforce understood the reason why we are suspending occupational licenses for the collection tools. We use this tool extremely judiciously. Since 2013, we've only issued 167 notices of intent to suspend, and we've actually only had to suspend 95. And those are all license types. Those are not just CDLs. Last year, we suspended only, I think, 11 CDLs, and the year before that, only two. The Dash 1 amendment takes out our statute that talks about the collection tool. Last biennium, we collected over $500,000, or right around $500,000 in delinquent tax. And so that amendment takes away the concern that the department had with our collection tool being limited for different types of occupational licenses, if that makes sense. So with that, I'm available for questions.
All right, before we take questions, clarification. So Dan, basically the Dash 1s, the Department of Revenue is supporting?
The Dash 1 gives the clarity that the Department of Revenue needed one way or the other in the policy decision that the body makes. So yes, okay. We understand it to be clear.
Right, let me open up for questions for anyone on the panel. I have a couple for Tori, but who would like to start?
Well, I guess I'm a little confused. The 693 from last session, I don't remember there being concerns raised about the sections, I think you said 23 through 28, regarding the juvenile suspensions. Is that new to this bill?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, I think we did provide some testimony the last session on this same bill. I think obviously, having a little more time to review that, there were some other sections that came to our attention that concerned us.
Just to explain, I was just wondering if that was new, because I just don't remember it being brought up. But I'm not saying it wasn't. I want to make sure it was the same.
I do remember some concerns. I don't remember the specifics, but
yeah, I think we focused last session was really on the MIP alcohol and marijuana piece, and we're kind of leaving the parental piece and educational piece out. And then as we're thinking about, you know, what representing juveniles and kind of that piece of it, we felt like those were also strong points that kind of help kids stay in school and, you know, have the parents' ability to monitor their children, which then hopefully keeps them out of our system. So,
okay. So Tori, let me just do a segue on the questions that Senator Thatcher asked. The parental revocation, are you telling the committee, as the law is currently written, a parent does not have the authority or the ability to go to DMV and basically have their child's permit pulled or revoked if they're underage?
I think currently the law does allow that. I think the way the bill is, it's removing that right from the parent.
Okay. I think. And then the other question I had on the same area, you made a comment about the use and lose. I think I took away from your subsequent context to this that it's not mandatory, it's discretionary, and it's at the court level that the judge would have to do it, and it wouldn't be done at the agency level?
Currently, current law is if you're adjudicated, for example, an MIP alcohol, there is a license suspension attached to that.
Automatic?
Yeah.
Mandatory.
Okay. What commonly happens, I can tell you from my own county, is a youth comes in that first time, as I explained, it's diverted. We do some educational stuff with them, help them hopefully understand not a good choice for them at this point. We get another referral. They're going to go to court. What we look at is the youth willing to do treatment? And if they are, then we kind of hold that in abeyance or do a continued disposition often on those types of cases. And so it's kind of held if they complete treatment and do what they need to do, the case is dismissed. Often parents and kids come in and say, we're not interested in doing treatment on that second time. And so we go through the court process and they would lose their license. But at least we kind of evaluate that and see who's, you know, if they're wanting to take care of some issues or they believe that there's a problem, that there's an avenue to do that without a license suspension. And then kind of holding that as the carrot of if you complete what you need to, then you wouldn't be suspended. Other kids that come in and they don't want to do treatment or they just want to have a fine and be done, then they do lose their license.
Okay. So let me just follow up on that because I just want to get clarification. At the point of where the first referral comes to the agency,
yeah,
my understanding, well, it's not required, but virtually all of these would be handled in-house at the county level and would not go into the court. So my question is, does the agency have the authority to have the suspension go into effect based on an informal agreement or whatever term is used for whatever agreement is made between the juvenile department and the child and their family?
No, the juvenile departments don't have any authority to revoke the license. That comes from the court.
Okay.
Yes.
And the last question I have on this is you made a comment regarding deadly addictions. You want to clarify as to what you're talking about? This is a time where you want to make certain uses or making good decisions, and I'm just wondering if you're attributing that and the two substances I heard you say was alcohol and marijuana, that those right. are deadly addictions, or are you talking about being gateways to something else?
Excuse me. Yeah, Senator Prudensky. I think what I'm talking about is, as we know from research, that the earlier that kids use, the more likely they are to be lifetime users and have issues with drug and alcohol of addictions and those kind of things. So I think it's anything that we can do to kind of help solidify for kids that wait till you're 21. We have better results with those people down the road, health concerns, all of those things that we all pay for as a society.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Other questions from anyone on the...
Senator Prezansky, members of the committee, if I may, I just did want to add one point of clarification. It's correct that the bill does remove a parent's ability to request that DMV suspend or revoke their teenager's driver's license, but it does leave in, if I'm remembering correctly, the section that requires parental consent for a minor to obtain the driver's license in the first place. I think I'm remembering that correctly.
I believe that's right.
All right. But the clarification for me is that basically once they got the license, the parent cannot come back in for whatever reasons to have the that privilege taken away from their child. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's the way it's written
right.
In the bill.
I've
used that. I have two 17-year-olds right now and I have used that point of driving as a privilege. And if I don't think you're doing it safely, I have that option to be able to go. And I think that's a good option for parents to be able to have that conversation with their children.
Yeah.
All right, Senator Denborough.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I actually don't remember us discussing that issue of the parents' ability. you'll remember, or you probably don't remember, colleagues, but this bill was actually originally came from Senator Winters and Senator Courtney. We had another version coming out of the work group, and we ended up, since that bill was there, we ended up deferring to that bill. So we never actually discussed that. We did discuss the other issue, we heard testimony that there are many teenagers who are responsible for transporting their siblings who are going to work, and the loss of their driver's license when they did, they were fine drivers, they were not a danger on the road, seemed unnecessary and wrong. So I think that's why we came up with it the way we did.
Okay. Any other questions from anyone? All right. Thank you all very much. I'm going to ask once again, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 1538? Not seeing anyone raising their hand or running up, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. I do understand that revenues come in on this. Chair does have a couple of questions, so we're not going to be working the bill today. I'm going to speak with Senator Denborough. I will just put on the record for myself. I do want us to look at the bill as it pertains to parental revocations. I just think that this is something that I want to make certain we're all on the same page as to how and when that could be used or should be used. And such. So with that, we'll have this rescheduled for a work session once we have an opportunity. And so, Whitney, if you all work with Senator Denborough, and I'd also like to make certain that Senator Winters is brought into the loop on this so we can make sure we have all the T's crossed and the I's dotted. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which will be on Senate Bill 1556. And Senator Hansel, I understand you want to lead off. And so why don't you go ahead and come on up. to do so. And I'm going to just put this on the record. We will not be working 1556 today. There's been some discussions I've had with the interested parties on both sides of the issue yesterday, and because of that, I want to have a couple of opportunities for a small, quick work group. I'm going to ask Senator Hansel to join myself and Senator Bentz in meeting with a group of individuals within the who will be given testimony, so we can make certain we have clarity. So today's a good time for us to take in the information, putting questions out there so we capture whatever concerns other members may have, so we can work through that judiciously through the work group. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. First of all, I want to thank you for accommodating my schedule. I got tied up in a veterans bill this morning. I was supposed to be first up. You got confused. I wasn't first up, so I rushed up here. But, Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, Senator for District 29, Northeast and North Central Oregon. I'm here along with the Community Banks of Oregon to ask you to support and pass Senate Bill 1556. This bill would prohibit counties from suing Oregon banks incorrectly claiming that lenders owe additional recording fees for trust deed assignments never given to the county to record. Senate Bill 1556 is important legislation to both our community banks and their customers who need mortgage loans. Currently, when a bank sells a loan on the secondary market, they are not allowed to record the assignments to Fannie and Freddie. Some Oregon counties have filed lawsuits in state court for fees associated with the unrecorded assignments. They believe they should be paid for processing this paperwork they never received, and being paid for work they never did. Multnomah County sued six banks for fees associated with processing paperwork they did not receive. In the settlement that resulted, it states, the county will not index MERS for any of the MERS deeds of trust pursuant to its policy not to index a party identified or designated as an agent of the beneficiary. Simply put, nothing has changed. The banks still follow the same policy they had been. The counties are still getting the same information they were. The only difference is these banks being sued were required to pay large sums of money to Multnomah County. The Bank of Lewis and Clark, who is in the room today, will testify they made three loans in Multnomah County, and their portion of the settlement and their legal expenses was $58,000. I believe their response has been to stop making mortgage loans entirely. Our community banks, which many Oregonians rely on, will stop providing this service like Lewis and Clark did. In some of our rural cities and counties, a community bank is the only local financial institution the residents have to be able to use. This bill is essentially, if we want local community banks making mortgage loans to Oregon families, is essential if we want local community banks making mortgage loans to Oregon families moving forward. Members of the banking community, as well as Paul Costco over here, to testify on the bill and answer any questions you might have. I'd be happy to answer, if I can, any that you might. And Chair Przanski, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Before you take off, any questions for the Senator? Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and do the proponent panel first. Paul, Jeff Sumpner, and Jeff Bailey, if the three of you would come forward. And gentlemen, I'll let you all decide on how you want to do your presentations as who will lead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the opportunity to appear on behalf of the Community Banks of Oregon. I'm Paul Cosgrove, representing the Community Banks of Oregon, which is an important part of the Oregon Bankers Association. With the Chair's permission, I'll start with just a few comments, turn it over to Mr. Sumpter and Mr. Bailey, and then again, with the Chair's permission, make a few concluding comments. First of all, I'd like to state for the record what is not intended to be handled by this bill. This isn't a bill to deal with MERS, which is the mortgage electronic recording system, nor is it a bill intended to legalize MERS. MERS is used nationally. It's legal in Oregon. It's being used in Oregon. It's being used in Multnomah County, where the litigation first started and was settled. But that's not the issue we want to bring forward for you. This is a bill, and in fact, if the lawsuit that was now pending was against just MERS or Fannie or Freddie, there wouldn't be legislation here. Secondly, I want to make sure that it's for the record, this isn't a bill about changing the rights that any individual borrower has. We made it clear, I think if you look at line 21 of page 1 of the bill, we made it absolutely clear that there's nothing in this bill affects the rights of a borrower to bring whatever claims they want to against whomever they want, including their lender. This is just a bill to deal with the issue that Senator Hansel just mentioned for you, to deal with a lawsuit where counties, who you have authorized to operate certain systems for recording, but you've also, by statute, provided that certain recordings are permissive, not mandatory, that a lawsuit to collect recording fees for documents never given to the county for recording. And there's some good reasons why they weren't, and we can get into those in a few minutes, that a lawsuit on that basis shouldn't be brought forward because it's having the effect that Senator Hansel mentioned. So with that sort of introduction about what's involved and why we're bringing the bill forward, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sumter and Mr. Bailey.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Sumter. I'm the president and CEO of Lewis and Clark Bank. We're headquartered in Oregon City and primarily in Clackamas County. My perspective is a little bit different than Mr. Bailey over here. My bank was a party to the first lawsuit about MERS. And so I can give you my perspective as a community bank having dealt with that. As Paul said, this had a lot to do with the MERS system and electronic registration of trust deeds and all that. But from a community bank's perspective, we provide mortgage loans for our clients. It's not a large business for us. That's, you know, we're not a mortgage lender. But to take care of our customers, we provide mortgage lending, or we did. And for clients to be able to get the best mortgage rates, 30-year fixed mortgage rates, you use the secondary market. And so our only option into that secondary market as a community bank is to be a member of the MERS system, which is how we became a party to that first suit. And as the senator mentioned, since Multnomah County wasn't our primary business area, we had done three loans in Multnomah County. It's actually two borrowers. One borrower had two loans, and so three loans in total. And just for perspective, on each of those loans, we made on average about $3,000. So, you know, it's a take care of the customer. It's not a large profit center for the bank, which we did. And then we wound up in the lawsuit. And as a small bank, it was very expensive. And as the senator mentioned, it did cost us $58,000. So when you have that kind of differential, unknown risk, of being sued, we had to get out of that business. And I don't think, myself, I don't think it's better for the consumer to have less choices, as certainly people can go online and get their mortgage loans and that. But I think, as you'll hear, working with a community bank and somebody local, it's not a commissioned mortgage broker, I think that is a good option for clients. So we exited that business altogether. I think you will hear a lot about who's on the trust deed, Fannie or Freddie or all those things. I think the important maybe distinction from the community bank's perspective is when the loan is made and the trust deed is recorded and we have sold the loan, which allows the client to get that 30-year fixed rate mortgage, we have paid the recording fee at that time. So Lewis and Clark Bank or any community bank's involvement in that loan at that point ends. So we have been sued, and what we're trying to deal with this particular bill is not being sued for things that happen after we're a party to the transaction. So recordings that happen after Lewis and Clark Bank sold the loan goes to Paul's point about MERS. That's a MERS issue, and we're not here to defend MERS at all. That's not part of this bill. we're saying that anything that happens after that, we should not be sued for or have that risk. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Bailey.
Yes, thank you. Greetings, Senators. My name is Jeff Bailey, President and CEO of Bank of Eastern Oregon, headquartered in Heppner, Oregon. We have branches or loan offices in 12 Eastern Oregon counties, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 1556. Locally owned and operated community-based banks are critical to the local economy. We provide jobs and access to capital in some of the most sparsely populated areas of Oregon. My bank has been serving rural Eastern Oregon for about 73 years. In many of our communities, we are the only bank in town. In fact, in three counties, we're the only bank in the entire county, those being Wheeler County, Gillam, and Sherman counties. I tell you this to point out that in rural markets, we are often the only local alternative for customers getting a mortgage. In rural markets, there are very few plain vanilla home loan transactions. Most transactions require a local, intimate knowledge of the market, realizing that comparable sales for the appraisal purposes may be as far as 70 miles away. My reason for mentioning this is that a typical mortgage mill or an internet-based mortgage solution doesn't offer that flexibility and local market knowledge. They'll simply decline the loan and move on to the next deal if the transaction doesn't fit in that box. To provide this mortgage loan product to customers, we must deal with requirements set forth by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as my colleagues have mentioned. These systems require banks to follow their rules to provide the 30-year fixed rate loan that our customers, your constituents, want. Those rates are currently in the 4 to 4.5% range. Fixed. If we're prevented from using Fannie and Freddie, the alternative to your constituents is a 5-year adjustable rate mortgage at probably 6 to 6.5%. All qualifying borrowers should have access to long-term fixed rate loans for their homes. As a bank, we handle credit risk every day. But the risk that this bill addresses attempts to alleviate is another type of risk that is more difficult to handle. It's the unknown and unexpected litigation risk coming from third parties. My bank is currently looking to expand our mortgage division, our mortgage office, by adding 2 employees, an additional loan officer and a loan processor, in order to expand our mortgage business and provide better service to customers. But the litigation risks brought on by the referenced lawsuits force us to put those plans on hold. Frankly, the lawsuit risk for just playing by the rules, and I want to emphasize that the market lays out for us, is one that makes us ponder whether the mortgage business is one that we will be able to stay in. Reference Mr. Sumter's bank as well. I'm asking you to please support Senate Bill 1556, Protect Community Bank, community-based mortgage lending in Oregon, and allow your constituents local access to conforming 30-year mortgages. If the opposing view parties have a problem with MERS, then they should address that issue, but not take away customers and, again, your constituents access to long-term fixed-rate financing for their homes.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on this panel? Senator Bentz first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Complicated area. The bill appears to approach a problem of events transpiring in the past and perhaps those that would transpire in the future by prohibiting lawsuits against the banks. Why not, and I know there's remarks made, why not fix the underlying statutory problem that gives rise to the lawsuits? And I know in my conversations with you, Mr. Cosgrove, that the suggestion has been that there is no problem with the underlying statutes. The assertion being apparently that the lawsuit is brought based on common law fraud or some other theme and not the statute. So your fix is to bar past counties from relying upon past actions and then move forward. with the thought that the bill prevents the counties from ever bringing action against the banks. In this real, this is an odd way to solve a problem. You usually don't go in and head off litigants by borrowing the remedy. And so you need to go into just a brief amount of detail, because I understand we'll have a work group on this, but perhaps you can enlighten me.
Thank you. And you are correct, and to repeat something I said, just to make sure it's clear on the record, if this was brought by other than counties, if it was brought by individual borrowers, we wouldn't be here. The current status of the law in Oregon, and frankly, in a memorandum filed by the county's own attorney, they agree with this, is the assignments that are at issue in the lawsuit, where the claim is it was fraudulent or misrepresentation or deceitful or unjust enrichment. Those are the claims. Not to have recorded those. The current status of the law is Oregon law does not require those to be recorded. 86060. That's the law. And the plaintiff's attorney agrees with that. They've stated so in their own memorandum. The problem is they have used a series of events that involve MERS, which happens after the community banks have made the loan and made their recording, to try to describe a situation of fraud and deceit. And as I said, if that had all been brought against MERS, we wouldn't be here. The problem is those claims, which maybe have validity against MERS, that's not our issue, are being used to assert monetary damages against the bank that made the original loan, that recorded the trust deed, and then assigned it, and in some cases, as directed by Fannie and or Freddie, not recorded that assignment because that's what they were directed not to do. And that is consistent with Oregon law that makes it permissive, not mandatory. Now they're being sued. So that, you are correct that it is an unusual bill to bring forward, but it's an unusual situation we're in, I think. And that's why we are bringing it forward.
And one follow-up. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the normal course, in our conversation yesterday, one would bring, based upon what you just said, you'd file a motion for summary judgment and you'd be out of it. That'd be one remark. The other is, that didn't work apparently in the lawsuit in Multnomah County because of the amount of money paid. One would say, God dang it, that's a lot of money. Now, it could be a reflection, I think, of you, as you said yesterday, on the cost of discovery and the thought of having to go back through literally thousands of transactions as those trust deeds made their way through God knows how many electronic assignments. And that cost of discovery is your, as I apparently, the justification for this bill. It seems odd that there seems to be more to it when you sit in front of a judge and say, Judge, please give us a summary judgment on this because we don't want to have to go through those all that discovery. Tell me why that argument hasn't worked.
First of all, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bentz, in the Multnomah County case, before it got to that stage, it was settled. The big defendants, being a few big banks and MERS, sort of ran that litigation. The small banks were involved. They had their own counsel. But in effect, the decision on settlement was made by them. And it was made on the basis of costs of litigation, you're exactly correct, which is discovery and all the other costs of litigation. Just to give you an example of where we are in the second suit in terms of potential costs of litigation, I counted the federal court docket sheet yesterday. There are 30 separate attorneys involved in this case, 30 of them from out of state and in state. And that's an expensive proposition. And we've already had a number of motions, a motion to move it to federal court from state court, a motion to move it back to state court, which is denied, a motion to appeal that decision, which was denied. And right now, there's a motion pending in front of federal district court Judge Mossman to dismiss the case. Dismissal of cases like this is very difficult. In any case, it's difficult to dismiss a case unless you can show there's no set of facts that the plaintiffs can prove on which they could recover. And that is a difficult, the motion is being made. But in any case, right now the cost of litigation is mounting and continuing to mount, and it's especially hard on the smaller banks. To be frank, a bigger institution can absorb that cost easier. A smaller institution cannot. So I don't know if that answered all of your question. So if it didn't, I'm sorry, and I'd be glad to try again.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking that the work group, the discussion is probably better in the work group because this could go on for quite a while.
And we're open to discussing all of these issues, and happy that the chair has agreed to do that. We'll stand ready to be participants in that at whatever time is set.
All right, I'm going to put a couple more things on the record so we can kind of see what we're focused. I want to follow up with what Senator Bentz was bringing forward. And looking at the complaint itself, excuse me, not the complaint, the bill itself, on page one, taking lines 10 through 17, this is an area that we did not discuss when I was being briefed by the proponents, and this basically sets out where a county may not bring an action or a claim against a person based on, and then names off multiple things. As compared to what I was being briefed on, was that this bill was what I thought was exclusively going to be dealing with, is that they that the county clerks may not charge for basically work they didn't do, in the sense of where there's a unrecorded assignment. And also, I was briefed, as you mentioned, Paul, regarding the this section does not impact the rights of a borrower. So my concern or question is, what is the need for the language from lines 10 through 17? Is it the perspective of the proponents that this is what is required to actually attack and address the issues that are already pending in lawsuits that have been filed? Because it looks to me this would also prohibit any other type of claim based on the banks or the lender being identified as one of these nominees, agents, et cetera, for something that could be completely different than what we have before us.
Good question, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to respond. A, 2A, B, and C on lines 10 through 17 are, in fact, the claims made in the lawsuit. The request for damages is for the recording fees, because these things were not recorded. And the statement in A in particular is sort of the basis for the deception misrepresentation claim in the lawsuit. Okay. That somehow by adding in black and white that MERS is a nominee or MERS is an agent, which has sometimes been required at different times by various secondary market people we're talking about, whether it be Fannie Freddie or others, that is deception or misrepresentation. In fact, realistically, that is the case. They are the nominee. They are the agent. And the counties are saying by having that statement in there, that is misrepresentation in the public record. So, and then they want, they say that is not a basis for not recording, and we want the recording fees for doing it. So those are the three claims that are backing up the claims for misrepresentation, deceit. Again, to the extent there is any of that, our position is it's after the loan has left our hands.
Okay. Second question for me is, you provided my office with some documentation after we met, and I'm referring to the document selling guide published December 19, 2017. And it has kind of like a grid chart and talks about the following mortgage documents when applicable are required on all mortgages. When you drop down toward the end of that page, it says mortgage assignment. And there it says the original unrecorded, and I emphasize unrecorded, assignment of the mortgages to Fannie Mae from the server. When I was reflecting on that statement and thinking what our discussion was, it sounds to me that potentially Fannie Mae, or I guess it could be Freddie Mac, are wanting to make certain that the title has fluidness to it, that it can be moved from one place to the other, and they don't want it to be assigned to them and record it, because then you have to go through another process and procedure, and moving it to another I guess servicer or whoever that might be. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's accurate. And I would just point out that MERS was actually formed by Fannie and Freddie and the title companies 20 odd years ago in order to facilitate those kinds of transfers. I guess that the Freddie Mac documentations we provided staff are even more complicated. And as I read those, you are to provide an assignment and you're directed not to record it. But if you use MERS as the original assignee, it can be bought, sold to Freddie Mac. But if it's a subsequent assignee, it cannot be sold if it came from Oregon or several other states. I guess that's all a point of, we have several hundred pages of instructions from these people in the secondary market. And not to be facetious, but if they say send it on blue paper, in order to sell it, we'll send it on blue paper. I mean, obviously, if it was something that was illegal, we would not do that. But if they have standards of how they want it, if they want it in paper but not to be recorded, or if they then later on tell us to record it, if we still have it, we will do what they want us to do, again, so long as it doesn't violate Oregon statute.
Okay. And probably for one of the two Jeffs, or both, community banks, charters, are they state charters? I'm just trying to figure out, how do we distinguish a community bank from one of the larger institutions?
Go ahead.
We are a state chartered bank, Bank of Eastern Oregon. Right now, I believe there are 14 state chartered banks. Yes.
Right. There are community banks who are across the river in Washington who operate in Oregon, and they would not be chartered by the state of Oregon. They'd be chartered by the state of Washington. But we call them all community banks. What we're talking about is a list of banks that are not the national banks that you're used to. I'd make one caveat, though. It doesn't necessarily mean a national bank is always bigger and a community bank is always smaller. One of the smallest national banks is just sitting down the street, Pioneer Trust. It actually has a national charter rather than a state charter. Banks have the choice of picking charters.
Right.
And I consider them as part of the same issue, a small local bank.
We're just looking at what our potential options might be if we want to make modifications and how we might clarify, identify the different types of institutions.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. And my understanding is that the basis for the lawsuit is not on statutory claims, but on common law claims.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And then just for the record, my understanding is that the original loan is in fact recorded. That is, and that's probably universal across the board, to establish property has been sold, and whoever is the purchaser, who is the lender, and all that is recorded. And my understanding that the MERS program does in fact require that first transaction to be recorded.
You are correct. The trust deed that goes with the note when you actually make the loan, that trust deed is always recorded. And there's no allegation of concern about that involved in the lawsuit.
We're trying to set a record for everyone that might be out there listening and where we're going, so we can kind of make certain we know what's happening, because y'all are the certified smart people. We're just here like the sponge trying to take it in. Senator Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This particular solution to this difficult problem is not Oregon specific, is it? I went through some of the other lawsuits filed across the nation in this regard this morning, and it seemed to be all over the map. Is this legislation been brought in any other states?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bentz, not to my knowledge. None of the cases that have been filed in other states have been, all of them have been resolved by dismissals or relatively nominal settlements, I've been told, with three exceptions, three cases in other states. I remember one of them is Alabama. I do not recall, and I can find and provide for you what the other two states are. One party lost at trial, and it's up for appeal in that state Supreme Court. So those three cases are live. The only case, my understanding is, at the trial level anywhere in the United States at this time is this case. But that's my understanding.
There's been causes of actions filed. They just
Correct.
Haven't gone to the point of disposition.
Correct. They've been settled, like Multnomah County was settled or dismissed by motion.
And Chad just pointed out the other two states we believe are Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Thank you. Thank you very much for reminding me. Yes.
Any other questions?
I had a follow-up.
Yes.
Well, I'm at a loss to understand why the banks would be satisfied. Now, the settlement agreement I have not seen from Multnomah County, but apparently, I'm guessing, that the clerks settled that case in a way that precludes action again, ever again, in that county by the clerks. So what this is intended to do is head off similar lawsuits in the other 35 counties. That's the concept? Because I'm just wondering, as I look across the United States in these other suits, are there still spaces within those states where lawsuits could be initiated? I don't expect you to know the answer to that. I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benz, you're correct. I don't know the answer to that. I can certainly inquire and see if we can find out what the terms of the settlements were in other states, but I don't know the answer.
Thank you. All right. Is there any other questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Our next panel is going to be Brian Van Bergen, Steve Dingell, and Alan Rapaport. Probably, sorry, I probably butchered that last one.
Oh, that's all right. Rapaport.
Okay. The same thing. Whoever would like to lead off. Steve, good to see you.
Good to see you. Senator. Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dingell. I'm Lane County Council.
Introduce yourself. You want to lead off after I introduce?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Where do you want me to
go? Go ahead and introduce yourself, then I'll lead off.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. Senator Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, the rest of the committee, thank you very much for letting us be here today. I am Brian Van Bergen, Yamhill County Clerk, and here representing the Association of County Clerks.
Good morning, Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Alan Rapaport. I'm Washington County Council.
Good morning. And just by way of summary, I think my letter that I submitted in the record dated February 7th sets out our position. I do want to correct or make clear one thing. The issue, and Brian can speak to this, but certainly the concern from the county standpoint is not just not recording fees, but it is the accuracy of the records. One of the things that it is true, the original trust deed is recorded. However, the beneficiary that's named is MERS, which is a fiction. There is no person there. MERS doesn't exist like a bank or another individual. So that's what I want to make clear that. And there's been a couple of questions raised. We certainly do have the settlement agreement. We can provide that to the committee. But I want to make clear that from our perspective, that's what the issue is, the integrity of the index and the records. And Brian can speak to that in more detail. Second of all, we do, like we did last session, are certainly willing to work with the proponents about carving out an exception for the small community banks. The presentation that we heard, or that you heard just a few minutes ago, is almost identical to the one that we heard during the last session. And we were prepared to do that. But at the end of the day, what this really boiled down to was ending litigation, both litigation that's filed and litigation that's prospective. And as I mentioned in my letter, I think that's a very problematic public policy.
And just for the record, why don't you go ahead and restate your name so we just make sure people know who's speaking.
Very good. Thank you. Again, Brian Van Bergen, Yamhill County Clerk from the Association of Oregon County Clerks. The Association strongly opposes 1556. We encourage the body to consider the ramifications of overturning Oregon Supreme Court's decision in June of 2013 that determined that MERS is not qualified as a beneficiary under the Deed of Trust Act. We are today still continued. We are required to index MERS as a beneficiary, even though the Supreme Court says they cannot be. Our position is we think we are required to record a lie. The OACC, Oregon Association of County Clerks, believes that we are required to have a clear, clean, and complete, affordable, and accessible public record of property ownership and interest documents. Our constitutional mandate as recording clerks is to provide that permanent record for all. Those that own properties, those that have an interest in properties, to buy, sell, improve, or whatever. It is dangerous, in our view, to trust a third-party private monopoly that could be bought or sold or go bankrupt tomorrow to be the sole interest registrar of assignments. It is in the citizens' best interest to have those documents recorded in the public record, in their local recording office. Again, our request is to have a clean, clear, and complete public record. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's harder to follow up on that. But again, we are interested in protecting the record of what is recorded and having the consumers be able to find out what the what was recorded. It was a problem during the mortgage crisis to find out who owned your loan and who you'd negotiate with. And that ended up creating zombie houses for the counties and local governments. So we are interested in maintaining the system, and it's been raised up, well, then let's, we're not stopping any lawsuits, we're just stopping the counties from suing. But who is going to defend the system? This is the system that the county maintains, and we are the people that are out there who are able to defend the system and have the interest of the citizens in that defense. And it'd be difficult for an individual to sue MERS or to sue all these individual banks, whereas the counties can able to do this. And again, this is a process where we're going to the courts. We're going to have a legitimate, neutral decision maker decide this case. And to have the legislature step in and remove that remedy from us, where we'd have the chance to go in front of this decision maker and go up to the Court of Appeals, then I think that's unfair and not good policy. And after the last case settled with Multnomah County, AOC approached MERS and said, let's sit down, all of us, and resolve it for the rest of the counties. And they would have nothing to do with that and rejected that settlement. So now we're forced to bring our own case. And again, we're still ready to sit down with MERS and the banks and try to resolve this thing through a settlement process. So we think this legislation is unnecessary.
All right. Steve? And if I could, I know there's been discussion about a work group, and I think that there's some things that definitely should happen ahead of that. One of the things as a number of individuals have noted, there seems to be a lot of back and forth. If you look at Senator Przanski, I know you have, based on what you said a few minutes ago, when you look at the regulations and the documents and the service manuals that are involved in this, they're literally hundreds of pages long with all kinds of different links. I would submit it would be useful for the groups to figure out exactly, because I know that there's dispute about what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac require. It would be nice to get a definitive answer from them about what they absolutely require and what is an option for lenders ahead of our work group, so that we know what we're dealing with. Because again, it just seems I can, for all the arguments that I've heard and read from the proponents, I read those manuals and I see that the opposite is true. So I think it would be useful to get from, if you will, the horse's mouth, the definitive answer. And I do want to emphasize, we did offer when Multnomah County settled to sit down and try and work something out so that we could have, as Brian mentioned, the accuracy in the records that the citizens are entitled to.
All right. First questions from anyone? I've got a couple I'd like to just. So let me start off with one of the documents that was provided to me is only one page of the plaintiff's response in opposition to the defendant's motion to dismiss plaintiff's amended complaint. This is the one that was in the Multnomah County case, I assume. On page 2, for the record, line 7, the attorney representing the counties basically acknowledged recording an interest in real property in Oregon is permissive, not mandatory. And it gives the footnote as to the case that was in 2013. And so if the counsel in that case, which I believe is involved in what the current pending case, has acknowledged that it's permissive, then, and it's not mandatory, I'm trying to figure out what basis are we now coming here to require them to do something that's permissive. So that's the first question. And then I guess the flip to that is, why hasn't the counties come to the legislature with legislation that would basically make Oregon a mandatory state versus a permissive state? So.
May I?
Go ahead, Brian.
Chair Przanski, thank you very much for asking that question, because that is a side issue in our view. Our primary concern, honestly, is the indexing of a fictitious entity. Our Our primary concern is that every time we record a document where MERS is involved, we are required to index that, and that is, in the Supreme Court's view, not a legitimate beneficiary. So that is our primary concern. The secondary concern is that we would recommend to anyone interested in securing their property's interest to record their assignments in their county's recording system. I don't know too many clerks that are anxious to require that. The permissive nature of that, in most people's view, is still recommended.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Brzezinski, if I may add to that, as you know, if you don't record something, then someone can jump in ahead of you and record something. So it is permissive, but obviously it is mandatory if you're going to want to get your security interest on that property. And that's our same thinking is going for the assignments as well. So,
and with regard to your question about the one sentence taken out of the pleading, I'd like the opportunity to get an answer back to you. I haven't seen, I'm sure there's context to that. There must be a sentence before and after. So.
Unfortunately, I only have the page 2. I really want it page 3 because.
Well, I'll see if I can get you all of the pages. How's
okay.
that?
Okay. All right. Any other questions for the panel? As Senator Nuttigam.
With regard to the concept of not knowing exactly what are required by Freddie and Fannie with that regard and having that be just a, well, we think concept, that's really hard to base all these opinions on when it's not known. And then in Mr. Pringle, in the last line of your first paragraph of a letter you submitted, you say you refer to lawsuits by Oregon counties for damages to their official records caused by MERS. And this is a very direct causal relationship, like this is required, and we've been talking, this is permissive. It's not a requirement, and if it's not a requirement, it can't be a causal relationship because it's, quote, not a requirement. And then not knowing what Freddie and Fannie require and the Supreme Court, this sounds like the key to, well, wait a minute, and the lawsuit then seems to be in this kind of ever-changing opinion, and nobody knows what the real deal is. So I'm wondering if you can comment on that. Mr. Pringle, you're the one who used that causal relationship sentence in your correspondence.
Right.
Just for the record, it's Dingle.
Oh, excuse me.
I've heard a lot worse.
I was thinking about potato chips.
I'll take that as a compliment. Chair Brzezinski and Senator, what I was trying to get to there is what Brian referenced, which is this awkward situation where the clerks, on the one hand, have this this duty, and right now one of the primary reasons that we hear from the lenders is this, their understanding of this requirement that they must do this, basically what you heard from the first panel. And that's why, and I believe that's why the plaintiff's attorney, that's one of the grounds for doing this, which is there is a dispute about this. And I would submit that before we dismiss, this body considers dismissing pending litigation and or legislation that addresses it, it would be nice to know the grounds that we're working on. For what it's worth, I've read them, and I don't read them the same way that the bankers do. Not, that's just me. I'm one person. I don't think that they're required to do some of the things that they say that they're required to do. And the only person or the only body that can answer that definitively is Freddie and Fannie, in my opinion. I hope that answers your question.
All right. Let's see. Senator Thatcher, and I know Senator Bench is also, I'm just going to let Senator Thatcher first, since she's not participating in this one yet.
Thank you. Well, I think it's a quick question. What I heard was when the community banks were testifying, they mentioned that once they do their loan and they do record it and then it's sold off, it's out of their hands. Why are you going after them, and why aren't you going after MERS?
Well, I think it's Chair Brzezinski and Vice Chair Thatcher, I think what the connection is that they, when they do the initial recording, it's who they assign the mortgage to, which is MERS. That's the connection.
We'd want them to change their practice to record the actual lender, not the not MERS.
Not
the
MERS.
Fiction. The Supreme Court determined that MERS is a fiction, and we want them to put in the actual lender.
If I know it's kind of hard, if it's a little difficult to understand, but as Brian explained, the Supreme Court said that MERS cannot be, because they're not, because it's a fiction, can't be a beneficiary. So that's how the banks are, and I understand what the community banks are saying is that in order for us to access that secondary market and get that level of interest, we must name MERS. So that's where to me that really does sum up the conflict. The clerks are saying we don't want to do something that is contrary to what the Supreme Court has said. The banks are saying we have to do this because we need to access this better interest rate in the secondary market for our clients, and that is the conflict.
Senator Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, your statement of the issue is well done. What was lacking was the solution. But getting to some of the research I did this morning, maybe this will present the issue somewhat more clearly to you guys, and you can give me the answer. My understanding is that MERS grew out of the kind of a parallel arrangement to our stock exchanges that were put together years ago because people knew they were going to be buried in paper stacked clear to the moon if they had to do it by paper. Mm-hmm. And so the MERS situation grew out of the fact that if we were going to trade mortgages and access all the capital that would become available and has become available through Fannie and Freddie with all the negatives of the 08 crisis, there had to be a electronic system of managing the situation. So my question to you is, at what point will our county clerks reach that electronic future that will enable us to get past this impasse that apparently is being built out of what I view as a kind of a antiquated system on the one hand that each of our 36 counties enjoy by virtue of perhaps lack of appropriate funding, who knows, and then on the other hand, the modern day means of bringing massive amounts of capital to bear. So we can go back into the particulars of that we've been engaged in the last hour, or we can go to the solution. So tell me.
Okay, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Bentz, first of all, I think a lot of those questions might be answered by Brian. We're willing to sit down, and there is a solution, I think, somewhere in terms of working this out and getting, finding, striking that balance. Again, this isn't about just trying to, sometimes I think that people really don't believe, and I hopefully you saw the sincerity from Brian. I know that our clerk feels the same way, Ms. Betchart. That they think it's important that these records be accurate and that they reflect and that people be able to go in and find out where, you know, it seems like it's an old-fashioned idea, but you go to the clerk and you find out, you go down and find, you know, do your chain on a piece of property.
Mr. Chair? Okay, so my understanding is, and I've never done it, is that one can go into the evolving electronic system that MERS offers and do exactly what you said, tracing through perhaps God knows how many transactions. And so to suggest that we're going to impose upon our counties the obligation to record thousands of documents seems odd. Is that what you're telling me that you want the consequence of this to be?
No, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Bentz, no, I'm not. I'm talking about what the situation is, and I know that up until and I know it's been represented. I know that the last time that we, when this issue came up in the last session, private citizens could not access MERS. They didn't do that.
I know. Chair, if I may, the question is, are you asking us to suggest in any way that we record every one of those thousands of transactions that one of those trust deeds might go through after Bank of Eastern Oregon makes the loan?
Senator Bentz, I'm not sure what the answer is. I just know the answer is not not stopping the litigation and getting us to a place where we can solve it. And I think Brian is better has the knowledge to address that latter question in terms of the recording.
Chair and Senator Bentz, yes, please do. All counties in Oregon do e-record today. And you go across the river into Polk County, and 60% of all of their documents are recorded electronically. They never see a piece of paper for 60% of their documents. It is much faster, much easier for us to record. When a county clerk today in Oregon receives a recording with an error, we can send that back to the submitter in 5 minutes. We have it recorded again after they've resubmitted the corrected document. Today we are recording e-recorded documents in a fraction of the time that it used to. So when this topic came up a few years ago, you were FedExing documents back and forth to the East Coast that would take a week and an exorbitant amount of money to get that done. Today we're doing all that electronically.
Senator Przanski, may I address Senator Bent's question as well?
You may.
Thank you. So I've talked to my clerk about the question about electronic and the future of recording systems, and Washington County is very interested in that. We're a high-tech center of Oregon, and we want to pursue that. But crucial to that is to maintain the recording system and the fees that are essential to that system. This is an expensive system to maintain that benefits all of us. It benefits the banks. We all know, we know what the recording system is, what the property is. It provides for the survey system and the mapping for the counties. So to have that future where we can have an efficient system, we need to maintain the existing system we have.
All right. Senator Wagner, I'm not sure if you had a question. I thought I saw your hand go up for a second.
No.
All right. So the last, I guess, for myself, unless there's other questions, MERS and the part about it being a fictitious, and I think, Brian, you're giving that testimony, or Steve, it may have been yourself. Looking at this response from plaintiffs where it has the footnote, it talks about the Branup versus Recon Trust in 2013. That's Oregon Supreme Court. Is that the case where they made that determination?
Yes.
All right. And then is there any reason? I don't know. This is kind of like coming out of nowhere. We make MERS not be fictitious and somehow do some type of legislation where we in Oregon say it can, in fact, be listed, and then the suits could go, in fact, directly against MERS.
I think that would be a better system than stopping the litigation. I mean, you know, I think it would be a better proposal to, if just, that'd be certainly a more clean cut.
Interpreted.
All right. Yeah. The Lifeline will have an opportunity. Hang on 1 second there, Rob. Let me go ahead and go to Senator Benz.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. So it would be extremely interesting to me if the clerks could to take one example of one of these trustees that makes its way into the Fannie Freddie morass and showed us the total amount of recording fees that would have had to been paid if there was a recordation every time that lender changed. Because of course, as those notes are sliced and diced into different trunks and moved around, the lenders become almost uncountable. So I need the numbers, because I have an idea that would impose a cost upon these transactions that would make no one want to buy anything in Oregon on time, and no bank would have any business. But perhaps you can give us an example of if the future is as you have suggested it, and that fees are paid at every moment there is a transaction, how much? Give us an example. And I don't need it now.
I have an answer for that, Senator Przanski. It's a one-page assignment. It costs $41 to record. And a two-page is 45, at least in Washington County. And the county gets very little of that money.
No. All right. Let's do this. Rob, did you want to come and join the panel, or did you want to?
Can I just add one comment real quickly? Can I get your seat real quick, Steve?
Sure.
Because I think, I'm sorry, for the record, Rob Ovett, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties, I think we got a little sideways on talking about the litigation. The litigation is against MERS. MERS is the primary defendant in the Multnomah County litigation and all the litigation that's going on right now. The Multnomah County settlement, and I don't want to be careful here because I don't want to mischaracterize it, but in my view, it does two things, and it resolved this issue. One, damages were paid. $9.5 million were paid to Multnomah County. $9 million of that was paid by MERS. Two, it allows Multnomah County, specifically by the terms of the federal settlement agreement, to not index MERS. So we have a solution. We don't index MERS in one Oregon county. I myself suggested to MERS through their counsel that they settle us out in the other 35 counties on very similar terms, and they rejected that. They want to fight us county by county. So I just want to put that on the record because that's my involvement in these cases, and that's my understanding of these cases.
All right. Thank you for the testimony. All right. Any other questions for anyone else or from anyone else for the panel? All right. Gentlemen, thank you all very much. So I'm going to ask, is there anyone else who has not given testimony on 1556 who would like to be on the record and put anything on the record? Not seeing you, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 1556. As we started the public hearing, I stated that there's going to be a work group. Chana Newell will be our point person. And what we're going to do is the members that will be part of it is myself, Senator Vince, and Senator Hansel will be on from the Senate legislative portion. And we'll make certain that we bring in individuals for interested parties from both sides. Our goal, because of a short session, is to do this as quick as possible, maybe as soon as maybe tomorrow. I don't think we're going to be able to do anything today. But I'm hoping that tomorrow or Friday we will be able to get everything together. So that is, I guess, for those who are going to be participating, my request is to have your thinking cap on and all of your multiple options and stuff, because we want to see if we can address this to ensure the best results for all of the citizens of Oregon. Any other questions, comments? All right, thank you all very much. We'll be back here tomorrow, 8:15. We're adjourned.